House Labor and Commerce has now come to order. It's 3:25 p.m. on February 21st. With us, we have Speaker Chenault, Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, myself, Chair Olson. We do have three members that are excused, but we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. And the first item on the calendar today is Commissioner Rodell from the Department of Revenue. Welcome again back to Labor and Commerce, and you've got our undivided attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell, and I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. We will be starting on slide 16 as a carryover from the presentation that was handed out to you on Wednesday. And I think it'll come up on the screen here momentarily. On Wednesday, we had the opportunity to review the heads of agreement. The HOA provides the framework which lays out the expectations of each of the parties. In Article 5 of that agreement, we outline and describe the state's participation. Article 5.3 specifically expresses the desire to have the state's participation in each component of the project to be consistent with the state's gas share of approximately 20 to 25%. So how do we construct the state's participation? The state's participation in this project is going to require significant financial and human resources. We believe a path forward was to take advantage of a partnership that was in existence. Our partnership with TransCanada under the AGEA framework and the investment made by both the state and TransCanada made them a natural partner to assist the state in moving this project forward. I believe the state needs a partner on this project. It needs a partner because at the end of the day, we are a state government, and we have an obligation to Alaskans to continue to provide a safe, prosperous environment in which to live. In the Department of Revenue, we will need to continue collecting taxes, auditing taxpayers, processing permanent fund dividend payments, and administering child support. In addition, a partner will bring expertise that we do not have. TransCanada is an independent pipeline company that knows how to get pipelines built. Not only that, they have spent the last 6 years developing and understanding the environment and challenges unique to Alaska. Therefore, I, as Commissioner of Revenue, along with Joe Balash, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, determined it was in the best interest of the state to enter into a memorandum of understanding with TransCanada. What is an MOU? So first, it is a legal document outlining the terms of the state of Alaska's relationship with TransCanada in the midstream component. It is often the premise to a formal binding contract, and it is given weight in a court of law. Our MOU with TransCanada outlines our expectation of their participation in the midstream, and it will not be binding until this legislature enacts enabling legislation. Moving on to key terms within Exhibit C. Exhibit C is the Midstream Services Agreement, which sets out the commercial terms under which TransCanada shall operate and expand the midstream components of the AKLNG project. It provides a favorable debt-to-equity ratio of 75-25 for rate-making purposes, and this will reduce the state's tariff. Lower tariffs not only improve the state's overall cash flow, but allows us to provide lower cost gas to Alaskans. Cash contributions by TransCanada. TransCanada, as the project developer, will reduce the state's exposure to cash calls and obligations until the pipeline is in service. There's improved value to the Treasury, and when you consider the opportunity cost of utilizing the state's capital, which earns 6% in the Treasury, but not just only earns 6% of the Treasury, but preserves our flexibility going forward in terms of how we use that cash and what we use that cash for. Our NPV is improved overall. TransCanada today committed to a 70-30 capital structure for expansions, and they also committed to at least 5 offtake points for gas to Alaskans with distance-sensitive rates in 3 zones of delivery. So where are we today, and why do we feel we have this momentum? First, we have the settlement at Point Thompson. This has led to a workforce of almost 1,200 workers and the development of core infrastructure to move oil and gas resources. We now know that we have access to the significant volumes of gas needed that, when combined with the gas resources in Prudhoe Bay, allows us to enter into those long-term sales contracts. Secondly, in 2011, the governor called for the various parties to shift their focus to LNG and determine if they could align on a project together. The work done by TransCanada and ExxonMobil under AGEA and the Alaska Pipeline Project, along with BP and Conoco under the Denali Project, provided a foundation for the concept selection. Concept selection is simply undertaking the research to determine if there is a project and what that project should look like. This past October, that phase concluded with the determination that an LNG project with a gas treatment facility on the North Slope, 800 plus miles of pipeline, and an LNG plant and related marine facilities located in Nikiski would be that project. This conclusion demonstrates above all else that when all of us, the state, TransCanada, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips combine forces, we could and can advance a project and take us to where we are today.
Can I interject?
Yes.
I want you to break it up, but on back one page, the 70-30 split?
Yes.
Which TransCanada entity is committed to that of the two?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand.
We have two separate TransCanada entities that are involved in the project. We've got the parent corporation, then we've got the new...
Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're asking now. It is the parent company that signed the agreement, that signed the MOU, and that they made the
commitment. That's
perfect.
That's what I thought, but I want to make sure. Thank you, though.
So we have the concept selection, and we have the investment into that, which was $330 million by the state under AGEA, $130 million by TransCanada and ExxonMobil as our partners under AGEA, and under the Denali project, BP and Conoco spent approximately $200 million. When we get to the end of April 2014, we will go into pre-FEED provided enabling legislation passes. And under that, all AGEA and Denali work will be contributed to the AKLNG project. The state and TransCanada mutually agree to abandon AGEA. And if we decide not to go forward at all or to not go forward with TransCanada, we will need to decide if we want to buy the balance of the data that was produced by TransCanada and ExxonMobil in connection with AGEA.
Mr. Chairman?
Certainly, Representative.
Thank you. Commissioner Riddell, as I said on Wednesday, I'm comfortable that the treble damages issue certainly is not at play if we do have a relationship with TransCanada. But you seem to say that there would be mutual abandonment, and then you don't want, I understand, in the event of mutual abandonment, then $130 million would be paid for the other information, the balance of the AGEA funds, in a sense. And then the divorce, as it were, would be recognized. But I'm not so sure about that part. And I wanted, in other words, that suggests that TransCanada would agree to mutual abandonment of AGEA, even if we don't partner with them on the Alaska LNG line. I haven't heard them say that. And that part does give me some pause.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I can say that we haven't had those conversations yet about how that would look and work in the event that there is either no enabling legislation, or if that enabling legislation precludes TransCanada's participation going forward. TransCanada is prepared to work with us on unwinding that. They recognize that there is no request in the fiscal year 2015 budget for any additional AGEA work, that there will be no further funding of the AGEA license going forward. So the it will be a process of how we evidence the end of AGEA in that process. But we have not had those conversations to date because we have been proceeding along with the memorandum of understanding.
Okay. Just as a follow-up, mostly a comment. I'm not presently concerned about staying in a 30-year relationship with TransCanada, mm-hmm. personally. However, unless we followed Don Bullock's advice and said this is uneconomical because it's really designed to go to Alberta, and that clearly is uneconomical, I'm not so sure that TransCanada is going to just let us off the hook with if we cut them $130 million. In other words, we'd better be married. That's sort of how I perceive this. But you can tell me if I'm wrong, and you sort of have.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't represent TransCanada, so I don't want to preclude any actions that they're entitled to take,
okay.
or the state, for that matter, to take.
Okay, thanks.
I think the rate or the route to Alberta failed on three different occasions, and I don't think it's a factor at all at this point in time. It just didn't pencil out. And so I believe that's why we're going in the direction that we are.
Sure. It's just that, if I may, at Resources Committee that I attended, Mr. Bullock said, really, technically, AGEA is still technically about Alberta, and an abandonment question would concern Alberta. I'm hoping that some of these become just academic questions for a history novel and nothing more.
Is Joe out in the hallway by chance?
Mr. Chairman, no, he is. He is not. He is tied up with another committee.
But
I understand that there's tremendous nuances here with the AGEA law, and Department of Law will ensure that we walk this very, very carefully and make sure that we follow
Representative
what
Paul.
We need to do.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, probably more as a comment than anything else. I have concerns about how this is put together, but some of my concerns are how AGEA was put together, and we can't get a determination from the Department of Law or anybody else on what treble damages actually mean. And so, Mr. Chairman, as we move through this process and we get folks in front of us, I think there needs to be some very pointed questions to certain departments and others that are involved in this process, because we don't want to end up in a position where we have ended up with the AGEA process, not knowing what our final costs are to move to be able to get out of this process. And you're right, Representative Josephson, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen where anybody has said that TransCanada is willing to just sign off on the dotted line and then let's move forward. The way I look at this is it's a partnership that's been developed between us and the administration and TransCanada to move forward, and if we move forward in the plan as it's proposed, we won't incur treble damages or incur the wrath of or the threat of treble damages. So, Mr. Chairman, as we move forward, there are lots of concerns. But I did have, if I could ask the Commissioner, on this slide, you have Alaska's put in $330 million. TransCanada has put in 130 in Denali, BP, and Conoco, or in the Denali process, so they're looking at $200 million. And in the next phase, we're going to put $70 million into it. Did you have the number for what the big three were going to put into it, and is there any money that TransCanada is going to put into it out of their pocket?
Mr. Representative Chenault, through the chair, that takes me to the next slide, actually. So if we're able to move forward, the producers will be putting in between $327 million and $348. And what the difference is here is the first number is based on whether or not the state participates at the 20% level, and the second number is whether the state participates at the 25% level. So the estimated cost for pre-FEED over the next 12 to 18 months will be approximately $435 million. Of that, if the state is in for 20%, the producers will pick up $348 million. That'll go down to $327 million if, in fact, the state chooses to move towards 25%. The state's share of that, and this is for the liquefaction, is $35 to $43 million. And then TransCanada will be putting in $53 to $67 million for the midstream components.
Follow-up? New question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at 20%, we're looking at $35 million. If we're looking at 25%, we're looking at $43 million. And my curiosity is, I believe the governor's asked for about $70 million.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, I believe the fiscal note is around that. And for the record, my understanding was when AGDC put that together, they made certain assumptions. So they included a contingency over cost of about 40%, and they also included money for administration, staff and consultants and things like that. So I know that was the very first fiscal note, and as we go through this process and refine some of the numbers and settle on the state share, they'll be refining their fiscal note as we go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Commissioner.
At this point, at the end of this period, it's our expectation that we will be coming back with a series of contracts, and that those contracts will either be approved or not approved. You will have a decision before you whether or not we want to proceed on this project or not. And if we do go forward, it's also a time when we need to decide whether or not we want to exercise our option that TransCanada has offered us, which is to come back in and take back 40% of the project costs as we enter into the front-end engineering and design. And I think what's so helpful about this option is it allows the state not to have to decide today if we want to be all in or not. And it allows us to advance the pre-FEED work and come back and make that decision about how we want to go forward. If we want to stop, and we want to stop TC's involvement with us and take on 100% of that, we will pay TC the development costs that they fronted on behalf of the state through that 12 to 18 month period, plus a interest cost of 7.1%. So what happens once we've decided to go through FEED? This is a period of front-end engineering and design. It lasts 2 to 3 years and has an estimated total cost of $1.8 billion. The producers will take on between $1.35 and $1.44 billion of that cost. The state liquefaction share will be between $145 and $180 million. And the state share, if we have exercised that take-back option, will increase from the 145 to 180 to actually 230 to 290 million. TransCanada without the option TransCanada will be in for 215 to 270 million, and if we've exercised the option, they'll be in for 130 to 160, so that's the 60% differential. I just want to make sure that there are no questions on that. And then becomes, at the end of this period, is the big decision. And do we have the approval by all the parties to go forward and start construction and make that final investment decision? And if the answer is yes, we go build. This is another opportunity to say, no, this is not the right time or the right project for the state of Alaska, and we can pay TC their development costs depending on that range. If we've come in for the 40%, we'd pay $183 million plus 107% AFUDC, or it could be as much as $337 million if they've taken on the whole project cost to date. So in summary, the Heads of Agreement and the Memorandum of Understanding do provide guidance on how the powers provided in HB 277 will be used, and that each stage in this project, there are clear off-ramps and decision points for legislative and public review, and commitments by the state will be made commensurate with progress by the project, and they will be commensurate with the other parties in this project. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions you might have.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the one that comes to mind is prior to going beyond the 2 to 3 years of from pre-feed to feed, I assume at that point, essentially 3 years from now, we would have, if we didn't have gas contracts with East Asia, then that would certainly end the project, right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct, because when we get to the end of the feed stage mm-hmm. and we decide to go forward, the state's going to have to decide how it wants to finance its share, whether TransCanada is in the deal or not. The state will have to come up with a significant portion of cash at that of financing of money to meet those capital costs. Calls for the construction. So if the construction cost on the state is a total of 10, just to use very rough, mm-hmm. easy math numbers, $10 billion, and the state's paying for $4 billion of that, we have to figure out at that point how we're going to raise that money and how we're going to adjust for that. I think that's one of the reasons, quite honestly, that we're taking some of the steps that we're doing today by including TransCanada in a partnership so that we are not trying to raise $10 billion in a time period where potential, where Department of Revenue is forecasting revenues today, with the knowledge we have today, to not be able to support that type of $10 billion in investment itself. It's also a time period where we're trying to do other things to provide capacity within our debt or liability look, whether it's moving $3 billion into the PERS and TERS trust funds so that we can create some relief within the operating budget and also some relief on the liability side of the ledger so that we can demonstrate that we can take on additional debt 10 years down the road.
Thank you.
Representative Chenault?
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reinbold?
Good.
Good? You got off extremely light. I figured you'd be going for about an hour, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time, and I tried to promise you that I wouldn't take long, so.
We can probably bring fish up here for filler, but no. Thanks again. And with that, we're going to take a break at ease. The next item on the calendar today is House Bill 230, ADA bonds for processing facilities. With us today, we have Representative Seaton. And are you going to present it, or both of you? All of you.
I'll present, but we might need Louis for a few things.
We got him for the big gun if we need him. Please read yourself on the record, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Representative Paul Seaton. I'm representing the Southern Kenai Peninsula. Appreciate the opportunity to hear the bill today. House Bill 230 is moving forward a strategy to put more oil into taps to increase throughput. An impediment to increasing oil in the pipeline, the TAPS pipeline, has been that there is difficulty of access to existing processing facilities, and those are for a couple of reasons. One is because there is water and gas constraints within the handling facilities for taking additional supplies, and there is also, companies want to reserve some space for their own product that they might be producing. So we're trying to help remove that impediment
Representative Seaton, I jumped the gun a bit. I'd like to refer the members to the blank CS in their packets, and could I have a motion to adopt the CS?
So moved.
Seeing no objection, the CS is adopted.
Pardon me? Okay, so.
We need a little better description.
Okay. I move Committee Substitute House Bill 230, version 28, LS1053, backslash U, as the working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you like me to describe the bill first and then the changes?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll proceed that way then. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So anyway, basically what House Bill 230 does is expands ADA authority. They are currently limited to $400 million bonding authority for all of their projects. And when we were talking about oil and gas processing facilities, they're expensive. So what this does is gives them additional authority for $200 million for oil and gas processing facilities. That relieves the constraint in two ways. One is that it's not clear under the statute that ADA has authority to currently do oil and gas processing facilities. And the other is that the monetary constraint is removed, as well as if the legislature approves this bonding, that will mean that we've given the authority to do those bonds and do those projects on a timeline that is necessary for commercial operations. We're trying to accelerate the production of oil from smaller fields into the pipeline. And one of the problems is if they have to wait, negotiate something, there's a $10 million limit in which they have to come back to the legislature for approval. So we're trying to get something going, they get contracts, but then we have to wait until the next legislature. So this approval gives approval for ADA to do up to the $200 million for oil and gas processing equipment and renovations. So this bill also creates a fund, and the reason we have that fund is that the legislature might decide to put money instead of using the bonding authority, but also as those bonds get paid back, we are, you know, we have kind of a history with ADA of negotiating these between 10% and 12%. So we'll be making money on these loans, and that's this way we have somewhere to designate that money to come back to in the fund, so it'll be used for oil and gas further projects instead of going into the current fund, which can be used for any economic development. So if the legislature wishes to target this extra bonding authority for oil and gas, creating the fund gives us the opportunity to make sure that's an ongoing process of our designation of where we want that economic development to occur. We, in this bill, there's a couple of things that we're looking at, and one of them is we define processing, oil and gas processing, and we define it in two ways. One is that it is taking gas, gas, water, those things out of oil so that oil is ready to go into the pipeline. And the other thing is it allows gas to be converted by chemical conversion to a liquefied petroleum product. Now that's a liquefied petroleum product by chemical conversion, so it's not LNG, which is just a phase contribution. So this would be for making gas to liquids available and stimulating that production, and we're going to need that because we have the emission control areas that are going coming into play, and we need ultra-low sulfur diesel. Right now we're having to import that ultra-low sulfur diesel where we could make that ourselves from gas supplies. So this could also be used in that aspect. So Mr. Chairman, I guess that's probably most of what we need to talk about. There was this same idea was put forward as an amendment last year when we were doing SB 21, and it was adopted by the Resources Committee. However, it would have caused the title change, so that was pulled out at a later date. But there was very broad support for trying to get in-state jobs. There's also one other section of this, and that's a tax credit. And that's a tax credit that was added in SB 21 for service industry, in other words, for Alaska jobs, making these modules in Alaska. So that tax credit is duplicated here just to make sure that that applies to making sure that the greatest opportunity is for these facilities to be created in the state of Alaska, manufactured, whether it's in the Matsu or whether it's in Kenai or whether it's in Fairbanks. If it's manufactured in Alaska, then that tax credit would apply. And that's why it's replicated here, because we just don't quite know the fate of that for next year. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's about all. We have Ada on the line, and if someone wants more information about the service industry tax credit, I can give you some, but we also have the commissioner here that could tell us more.
Additionally, we have Matt Founder from DOR Tax Division online as well, if anybody has any questions for any of the three. Representative Fairway.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, are you in agreement with the addition of the tax credit language? It sounds like you are.
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, yes, I think that that portion is the portion that is targeting for Alaska jobs. It's basically gives an incentive for building those modules and those facilities here in Alaska. We had one outfit, which was Brooks Range, that has a Mustang unit up there. We would have more oil in the pipeline right now if they could have gotten the financing at commercially reasonable terms to build those facilities. They were going to build them in the Matsu Valley, I believe, and truck those modules up. That would have a capacity of 15,000 barrels a day. However, the timing and moving forward on that project took too long, and so we still don't have that oil going into the pipeline. There are a number of other smaller outfits that would be in line to getting their oil in the pipeline as if their discoveries are proved up. But you got to remember that that processing facilities don't make you any money if you are processing your own oil. You sell your oil, but the only cost is you're costing yourself to get it processed, but then you sell it. So it's not a profit center to so it's more difficult on a business relationship to do processing facilities than it is exploration.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Yeah, just a couple. In your introduction, you suggested this was for, the implication was it was for the smaller independents, but could the larger companies use these credits, and is that the policy that, is that a policy that would be okay with you?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, there is nothing in here that says that it has to be for smaller companies. However, if it was a, you know, if it's a, if we're looking at something like an LNG plant, you know, we're talking about $20 billion. So this is not really where this is designed for. But if there was a necessity for larger companies to renovate facilities or something, they could also come to ADA and see if that made sense for them. The question is that they generally have better access to capital than the smaller outfits do, and yet ADA has been very very good about making sure that they're doing their due diligence in the projects that they fund, and so we'll just have to go from there, and you can talk to ADA about their due diligence and what they do on projects.
Okay. No. We do have Ted Leonard online if you would like to talk to him either later on or
Perhaps. Let me, I mean, just as a last follow-up, the reason I mention that, Representative Seaton, is the conventional wisdom is that the access problems that we that you presented for existing processing facilities are access problems for independents, and it seems sort of circular if we allowed. I mean, the controversy is whether the big three are allowing the access, and to then in, say the big three would benefit from the credit. Do you see where I'm going? And I just trying to solve the problem without exacerbating it.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, this credit is not on production. This is for, it's called a qualified oil and gas service industry expenditure credit. So this is if modules are built in Alaska instead of in Japan, then you could get the credit. And this credit is exactly the same as a credit that was approved under SB 21 for the service industry to incentivize building these facilities here in Alaska, creating jobs in Alaska, driving the economy of Alaska. So, and the combination of these two, whether it's SB 21 or whether it's as written here, cannot exceed the amount that's written in SB 21, can't exceed $10 million a year. So this is not an additional credit that that isn't already on the books. If SB 21 goes away in August, this would still allow for the stimulation of Alaskan hire and building these modules in Alaska. We just, you know, just a contingency there in case something does change this tax credit for incentivizing work in Alaska, building in Alaska would still be on the book.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw my objection to the committee substitute.
Oh, thank you. Any further objection to adoption of the CS? Seeing none, the CS is adopted as a working document. Any further questions, Representative Chenault?
Mr. Chairman, probably more comment than a question, a couple of them. Representative Seaton, last week you were, I know you're a man of many hats. Last week you were a doctor in the Health and Social Services talking about vitamin D bill, and I see now you're a reservoir engineer. Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, just for the record, when we start talking about access to facilities, there's a limitation to those facilities, and as a field is developed and oil wells are brought online, at first they start pumping a lot of oil, a little gas and a little water. And as time goes on, those numbers change, and sometimes they actually flip-flop. And I've seen wells that were 95% water. And so when we start talking about limiting access, sometimes even the majors that own their own facilities are limited to how much oil they can produce, just simply because of the capacity of the facility itself, and how the numbers and the percentages change on as those wells develop and age. And so, you know, they're very expensive. They're very expensive to operate, and they're very expensive to build. And while I agree with I think so far with the oil reservoir engineer that this is not a bad looking piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman.
I think that a lot of people would probably agree with you. Representative Reinbold?
No questions? Thank you. Yes.
Do you want to stay up at the table? And I'm going to bring on Ted Leonard for questions. Ted, are you with us?
Yes, Chair. I'm here.
Thank you for joining us today. I think Representative Josephson has at least one question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leonard, it's Andy Josephson. I guess principally I'd be curious what, if you know the maximum credits that would could issue under this legislation.
To the chair, for the record, my name's Ted Leonard, and I'm the executive director of ADA. Through the chair, that is one portion of this bill that ADA spoke to the sponsor about that we really can't testify to. That's definitely more the expertise of the Department of Revenue and those experts that you have with you there.
Your follow-up, or I can bring on Matt Fonder.
Just one. Mr. Leonard, is it your understanding that it would be at the discretion of your board as to whether these, whether the bonds would issue?
Through the chair to represent Josephson. I thought you were talking about the tax credits. I think I may have misunderstood the question then.
Well, I was talking about the tax credits, so you understood that. What I'm wondering is, all of the financing you do, is it statutorily mandated by the legislature, or do you have a board that meets and says, we're going to invest, of course, the LNG trucking scheme I know was mandated, but I'm just trying to get a sense of whether this bill would operate in your board's discretion, or how you see this?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, we are finance authority, and under our current statutes, we do invest in projects through direct financing or owning a portion of a project. So our board does go through due diligence phases on the project, and when we are looking at a project, we do decide what type of capital structure will work and whether or not we would issue bonds for a project. Under the current statute, if the board desires to issue bonds as part of this capital structure, anything over $10 million must be approved by the legislature before our board moves forward with issuing bonds. So, again, what this bill would be to say that, and that authority by the legislature is not in a way a mandate. It says that it grants us the authority to issue those bonds. Mm-hmm. We still go through our complete due diligence phase, and I believe we've gone through that with the committee several times. And before we would issue the bonds, our board would still have to approve the project as a project and per statutes show that there is a finance plan to pay back those bonds.
Thank you.
So in reality, what this bill is doing on that portion is saying that the legislature is in essence giving us authority to issue up to $200 million right now instead of going through and doing a bond authorization every time we believe we have a processing facility that our board would desire to look at investing in.
Thank you.
Representative Joseph, we do have a tax representative online if you have any tax-related questions.
Well, I suppose I do. I'm just curious how generous these credits could become. I certainly like the policy behind it.
Matt Fonder, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm with you.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation, and did you hear the question?
For the record, my name is Matt Fonder. I am the director of the tax division for the Alaska Department of Revenue. And Representative Josephson, could you please restate your question?
Sure. The question, Mr. Bonder, is if there's $200 million potential in bonds, but I'm trying to get a sense of how much the state would forego in taxing authority if credits issued, particularly. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I guess first I'd like to preface this with, I saw this draft with the credit for the first time this afternoon, so we haven't had a lot of time to analyze this. I think your question, though, I think the bonding and the tax credit issues are separate issues. The way that this section of the bill is set forth in Title 43, or Chapter 4320, which is our corporate income tax chapter. It just sets forth a new credit for oil and gas processing facilities. So to me, I guess I see it, the bonding and the tax credits as separate things.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the credits. How many people could conceivably take advantage of these credits? Is there any way of knowing that? How many companies could take advantage of them?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, at first blush, right now, it's the way that the language appears. It's any company that has an oil and gas processing facility on the North Slope, or any company that would like to build one, or any company that might be doing work on one. So it could be an oil and gas producer, I believe, or it could be a service provider that may be providing some of the labor or some of the work on construction or improvement on any of those facilities.
Okay. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I probably wasn't very clear. The tax credit here is the mirror of existing law. SB 21 has this tax credit for services. 10% of the qualified oil and gas service industry expenditures occurred in the state during the tax year, or $10 million, whichever is less. And we have language in here specifying that the combination of this existing tax credit with the mirror that we have in here cannot be combined. It's the same amount. So, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify that this isn't a new tax credit we're putting in here. It's just we wanted to make sure that no matter what the outcome of the initiative is, or the referendum is, that the tax credit to stimulate production of facilities in Alaska will remain the same and will remain in place. Yeah. So I'm sorry.
No, you were clear. If I can, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly, Representative Jones.
You were clear, Mr. Representative Seaton. So whatever the OMB and Department of Revenue project is our revenue under SB 21, particularly as to these credits, would continue, regardless of the outcome of the referendum in August.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is exactly the case, that these tax credits would be the same no matter which goes through. That implication would be there.
Thanks.
Any further questions? With that, thank you, Representative Seaton. We're going to open it to public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? With that, we're going to hold the bill over and keep public testimony open. We do have three committee members missing, and I believe at least one of them, or possibly two of them, wanted to weigh in on this bill. So we'll be bringing it back shortly. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. Next item on the calendar today is House Bill 300. And with us, we have Representative Kathy Munoz. And are you presenting?
I am.
Perfect. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, I would like to acknowledge Marty Hester, if he's still here. No, he's not here. Acting Director of the Division of Insurance. Marty and his staff work very closely with us on the development of this legislation. House Bill 300 would allow popular air ambulance membership programs to continue serving Alaskan residents. I have a very personal interest in this issue. My late father was medevaced out of Juneau 2 years ago, and that the ability to get out quickly truly saved his life. I know that these transports are very costly. They can run from anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 per flight. The membership program allows Alaskans to, or did allow Alaskans to buy a membership, and that membership served as the copay in addition to what the primary insurance would not cover the copay, if you will, was waived if the individual had a membership.
What would it do if they didn't have insurance? Would it pay the full amount?
You have to have a primary coverage in order to qualify for a membership.
Thank you. And I'd like to advise the people in the room that we had thought that the first presentation was going to run over significantly, and we probably had several people in the room that were planning on testifying on this bill, and I had indicated to everybody that the likelihood of us hearing it today was next to nil, and I apologize to anybody that we missed on that, but please continue.
Well, thank you, and it is very true that I heard from many residents in my community. 1,300 Junoites alone were participants in a membership program through a company called Airlift Northwest, and I know many hundreds of Alaskans around the state participate and had participated for many years. I think it was 3 or 4 months ago, finally, the Division of Insurance ruled that companies like Airlift Northwest could no longer provide this membership program to its customers. The specific example of Airlift Northwest occurred when they reorganized their company under the umbrella of the University of Washington. And when they did that, the transition made the company no longer eligible for an exemption under the Division of Insurance licensing requirements. As I said, I've heard from many of my constituents. Many were retirees worried about losing the AirCare membership plan. HB 300 would allow them to continue being members of this program and give my constituents and Alaskans peace of mind. Passage of this bill would help, as I said, 1,300 Juneau residents, 460 individuals from Sitka, 450 from Wrangell, 330 in Ketchikan, 200 in Puget. And this is just for the Airlift Northwest program. Other companies, of course, would be able to offer this program as well. I have letters of support in the packet from the Alaska Commission on Aging, the Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance, residents of Skagway, Juneau, Sitka, Wrangell, and Ketchikan, and I believe the executive director of Chris Martin is available either online or no longer. I'm sorry, she was available earlier today. But with that, I would turn it over to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for the sponsor? Representative Joseph?
I do not have
any. Nope, you had, looked like you had a question. I apologize. With that, we'll open it up to public testimony. Unless you have, I don't think we have anybody, we have people signed up for questions, don't we? And we've got people dialing in. Let's open it up. Shelley Deering, are you on the phone? Nope.
These are signed in. She left.
Signed in?
Okay. She left, Mr.
She left. You know, we've lost our quorum. We didn't lose our quorum. We found our quorum.
All right.
I think the best thing to do is, and I apologize again.
No problem.
I think we're going to hold it over now that we've got it read across until we can get adequate public testimony, because I know there's a number of people that want to testify on this, and I have not heard of anybody that is in opposition to this, so I think it'll move relatively quickly. But I've been advised that the companion is in Senate rules, and we expect it to come over shortly, so I know we're going to have one of the two.
And I've, Mr. Chairman, worked closely with the sponsor in the Senate on the legislation. It is exactly as
somehow I knew that.
It's the same.
I was working with them too.
Okay.
And with that, we're going to hold the bill over, and we will have adequate public testimony before the bill moves, and we will have a full committee, hopefully.
Great. Thank you, Mr.
And thanks again. Brief at ease.
Appreciate your hearing.
Come on up, Ginger. Last item on the calendar today is HCR 15, and for anybody that's listening, We have a number of members that are out today that wanted to participate in this bill, and it is my intent to read the bill across, have the sponsors representing give us a brief summary of it, and then we will bring it back shortly under bills previously heard.
Okay, thank you.
Please state your name and name for the record.
Yeah,
for the and affiliation.
Yep. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm staff to Representative Shelley Hughes. And she apologizes for not being here. She did go home for the weekend, probably for a little TLC for her.
I think with the rest of the committee.
Yes. her primary message to the committee is that unmanned aircraft are here today, and we need to be able to harness them for good, but still really keep privacy concerns at the top of the agenda. And that has been her major focus. And she brought the task force back to that point many times as we met and heard from the public through the interim this past year. So many people are intrigued with what unmanned aircraft can do, but almost everybody is concerned with the personal privacy aspect. You might find this to be contradictory, but the task force was actually a pretty fun meetings that we would hold, because the whole concept of unmanned aircraft is new and interesting, and every time we would get together, there would be a whole new development. We also had the opportunity to kind of do a lot of what-if scenarios and say, well, what if there was a little one and it flew in and did this thing? We would anticipate how it might behave. And do we have a law that would protect the citizen from that already on the books? And what we determined is almost everything we couldn't come up with that an unmanned aircraft might be used for, we're pretty well protected. And Alaska is unique in that way. Our Constitution has very strong personal protection language, and our statutes cover just about every scenario we could come up with. What we can't anticipate is how fast this industry is growing and changing. And just to give you an example, when I wrote the report just a couple of months ago, the what-if scenarios were more like, what if we're using it for search and rescue and this thing happens? What if we're using it for wildlife management and this thing happens? Well, so every morning I open my inbox and I get UAS news, which is Unmanned Aircraft Systems news. So the new things, it is exciting every morning. So today, the same military unmanned aircraft that have been used are about a meter long, so about 3 to 4 feet wide. It's called a Razor. It costs $76,000, and they use that for surveillance all over in different war zones. So today, there's a business in California that can use a 3D printer, print an almost identical aircraft in one day, load it with an Android-type technology, free apps. It can do the exact same business that $76,000 guy did, and it cost $2,000. So the industry is changing faster than we can probably manage at this point. one of the other fun things is Dubai is offering a $1 million award for anyone who can come up with the use for an unmanned aerial system that can improve government services. And the example in their video that they put online was a lady sitting at a computer, orders her driver's license, hits send, the little unmanned aircraft flies over to its house. They come out, they use a fingerprint to open the little door on it, pull out their driver's license, and the unmanned aircraft flies away. So no more DMV lines. That might be a good thing. But they're offering $1 million to replace government services with unmanned aircraft systems to improve their business.
I think I have one constituent that would really appreciate that.
Probably. The UAF, University of Alaska Fairbanks Engineering Department, actually created its own little unmanned aircraft. It sits in the palm of your hand. They can be as large as a 747 aircraft. And one of the other articles I got a couple of days ago, which was kind of a new concept to me, is that there are two Global Hawks that fly around in the South Pacific. I think it's Guam, where they mostly are. They monitor weather patterns. Japan has hired the United States to move a Global Hawk to monitor around Japan, especially where the nuclear accident took place a year ago. What I didn't realize is that the pilots of those aircraft, and the Global Hawks are about the size of a 747, the pilots sit in California. And they fly them around Guam and fly them around Japan, and they don't even need a passport. So it's a very new and dynamic technology. So back to the bill. The task force was very sensitive on privacy concerns, especially around law enforcement activities. We, for some reason, every one of our scenarios came back to how law enforcement might use it. And HB 255 is in House Judiciary right now, and it is dealing with law enforcement issues. It's providing procedures, data retention, and community involvement, and it kind of touches on those rules. The task force is a limited, it has a limited scope. And what HCR 15 is going to do, hopefully, is extend the life of the task force for 3 years, so it would go until June 30th of 2017. And that happens to coincide with the date of, or the life expectancy of the University of Alaska Fairbanks test site. So when the test site is done with its mission, so will the task force be done with theirs. The whereas section in the bill is all of the good things that we know. University of Alaska Fairbanks was selected as one of at the FAA's 6 test sites, and we're anticipating a lot of good out of that. A boom in some business, you know, some industry growth, and also being able to be on the forefront of some policy decisions that might affect how unmanned aircraft are used in the whole nation. So that's great. The task force right now is made up of 7 members, and in this bill we would ask that the same 7 members are retained, and we add 2 more seats. There were 2 important positions that were not always vetted correctly or fully. So DOT is actually not on the task force right now, and the Department of Law and Legal Services and others felt that a DOT representative would be very good on this committee, because that is the federal position, the federal point of contact for anything to do with aviation, national airspace, the FAA. That is their contact, whether or not they're using unmanned aircraft or not. And the 9th member would be a public member. We didn't have anyone who was just a general public person. Everyone had some kind of affiliation with aircraft use. So we felt those 2 would be great additions.
That's a quick question.
Certainly. Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is fascinating to me. I sit on the Aerospace Board, so I'm really trying to follow this. I'd actually like to get the link of what you are getting in your mailbox every day. But are you working with the Aerospace Board?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. We don't have a member on the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. We don't have anyone from that board. When we first wrote the task force a year ago, we had a board of, we had about 15 or 17 members on it, and it was cut down to 7. Felt that that was more manageable, especially if there was going to be any cost involved. And so the 7 members are the ones that passed out of both bodies, and that's what we dealt with. Adding these 2 came about primarily we needed to have a public position, and having that federal aviation contact point with DOT was necessary. Mm-hmm. But we haven't looked to add any more at this point.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I've got a question that we'll keep, or the answer I'll keep until the next meeting, but mm-hmm. is this going to put the university in a position where it's competing with the private sector? Are these services that the private sector might either may be already involved in or could be involved in?
Right.
In fact, you don't have to answer it now. But you can.
Right.
That way you can give me a detailed answer.
Yeah. And actually, Chairman, what I would recommend is that Ro Bailey, who is the director of the test site, she was going to try and call in today. She had a meeting just prior to this, so I don't know that she's online. but she'd be happy to address exactly their relationship.
Representative Reinbold.
I just heard a fabulous presentation by Ro. I was so completely impressed, and she did it through our university subcommittee budget, so I would highly recommend her speaking. She's one of the most knowledgeable people we've had before, at least our, for sure, our university subcommittee on this issue. So, yes.
Representative Jones.
I don't have any questions.
Please continue.
All right. So quickly, the resolves also included adding some new duties to the purpose of the task force. And these were a couple of links that we found were missing, and we didn't know how to put it into statute, and maybe we didn't want it to be in statute into perpetuity. So the first one, resolve number 3, says to evaluate complaints and concerns. There's nowhere that the public or businesses or government or anyone has to direct their concerns. The University of Alaska Fairbanks, their application and their program isn't really one to receive comments from just the general public that has nothing to do with the test site purpose. And so we felt that having a task force and having a central location would be a great way to be able to respond to all the citizens of Alaska. It was also, one of our others is to identify any potential privacy problems. And so it gives the task force an opportunity to evaluate the concerns and any information coming in and see if we do need to make some changes in statute. The fifth resolve is a point for public education. And we talked a lot about this, where any time a government agency or a private agency is running, basically flying a mission with an unmanned aircraft, we would like to have some avenue for public education to help eliminate the fear. And with new technology, there comes a lot of fear when you don't understand how it's being used or why. And then the other part of the extending the task force is that it fulfills one of the duties of the University of Alaska Fairbanks as being selected as a test site. They need to hold some public meetings. They need to be able to receive that public comment. And they felt that this might be the best avenue to do that. And then it also includes things on really studying and making recommendations to the legislature. And that's a great opportunity for a representative and a senator to be sitting on the board and professionals in the business. So, on behalf of Representative Hughes and the task force, we would appreciate you considering this with a positive light.
Any further questions for Ginger?
No.
We do have one person online that's been very patient. Is Steve Culligan with us? I am going to open up to public testimony and then keep it open until we have a full committee. And if if he is available and he chooses to call back in next week when we have a full committee, that'd be fine. Or we can hear him today and next week as well.
I'm here right now. I'm in my vehicle driving past Merrill Field here.
Oh, no.
See how it goes before I hit the dead cells off. But I'm just calling you. I'm a member of the task force.
Could you state your name and affiliation for the record, please?
Steve Colligan, Colligan, resident of Wasilla, business owner in Anchorage. And I'm in the mapping and technology business, but I've also been a model airplane enthusiast since I was a young man and grew up in Fairbanks, graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But more so, I'm very much a supporter of the Marine Corps to start with and to address public safety and
Steve, I hate to do this to you, but you're cutting out, and we would put you at the top of the list at the next meeting for public testimony, but we can hear about every third word. And again, I apologize for the length of time that we took to get to you, but you'll be at the top of the list at the next meeting on this bill. And with that, we will adjourn. Seeing nobody in the room that I don't recognize, we'll adjourn.